I'm going to do a little different intro today, and that is I'm going to give you the title of my message first. And the title is, and you'll recognize this, Lead Us Not Into Temptation. And of course, that comes from the Lord's Prayer, or what is popular, or popularly, if that's a word, known as the Lord's Prayer. It's the outline for the Lord's Prayer, but I think it's a somewhat neglected or at least overlooked portion of that example prayer that's not talked about or emphasized all that much. And it comes from Matthew, I think it's Matthew 6, 13, and I'm sure all of you have read it many, many times. There are some churches who, the church and the tradition that I grew up in, every prayer, at the end of every prayer, it was closed with that particular example prayer, the Lord's Prayer. And that's how the prayer was closed. But it's misappropriated and misused a little bit because it's mostly an outline for us to address our Father in heaven. But nonetheless, do not lead us into temptation, or lead us not into temptation, is somewhat neglected and overlooked. But amazingly enough, and this surprised me when I started studying about it and reading about it, the commentators look at that as a controversial statement, because they look at James, the first chapter, and we can turn there if you'd like, James chapter 1, and also in verse 13, James 1, verse 13, and they see where it says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. And they feel that this would be like saying that God, don't let me sin because you can't sin, so I couldn't sin. They sort of look at it in that vein and sort of mischaracterize it, I think, a little bit. They sort of twist it a little bit, or they have a skewed outlook on it. I would, in my, as I looked at it, I thought that that's sort of a strange way of looking at it, that you would say this about verse 13 of James as compared to verse 13 of Matthew 6. Lead us not into temptation. Because in their conflicts, they go sort of around in a circle, sort of some kind of circular reasoning about it, because they feel that it would be almost inappropriate to say that. But nonetheless, we'll get into that in just a moment. Temptation, it's Strong's number 3986. I am not a Greek, so I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it. The word itself, but the Greek word for temptation can mean either trials or testing, which many of us go through, and we know that just from reading the announcements with all the prayer requests, we see that there are so many trials and testing that we go through as individual Christians in the church of God. And Peter even alluded to this. Our brothers and sisters in the world also go through trials and testing just as well. It can mean that, trials and testing, the things that afflict us and so forth, whether it be illness, whether it be some other catastrophe, accidents, or loss of jobs, all the different things that we can run into. Or it can also mean, the other meaning can be, as probably the first thing that comes to mind, enticement to sin. It can mean either one of those. But in God's Word, there is a strong emphasis, there is a premium of placed on avoiding temptation, as we just read in Matthew 6 and verse 13, lead us not into temptation. James here actually has a diagnosis of the process of temptation. And he says, if we continue on, he said, first of all, we'll just go back to 13. James 1:13, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one, every one, is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. When we are drawn away by our own human nature, the lust of the flesh, and so on. And it's interesting, I found it interesting, the commentaries bring this out, and the words sort of imply that to be drawn away would be to be baited. It's a hunting or fishing analogy, or a hunting and or fishing sort of a metaphor here, that they're baited and lured by bait, and then they're entrapped. And that's what it sort of is saying here. They're baited and then lured by they're lured by the bait, and then trapped, then enticed. And then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. And obviously that, we know that it's not talking about the death that everyone goes through, because all people go through death. This week there were, if you looked in the obituary in your local paper, there probably several columns, depending on what communities you live in, of obituaries of people who have died. So we know that we're all going to die. We know that life is 70, or if by chance of strength it says if we add another 10 years or so to our life, and many people do. Many people these days are living into their 90s, and a few even in over 100 here and there. But eventually it is going to end. It did for everyone in the Bible. It did for everyone in between then and now, and it will for everyone at some point. So it's not talking about that death. It's talking about eternal death. It's talking about death that where there is no return from, where there is no more existence at all. It's basically what it refers to. Although it also means the death in between as well, because if there had never been any sin, the indication is there would not have been death either. But our first parents, Adam and Eve, obviously they sinned and introduced death into the world, and then death was followed up for everybody. But it probably means both of those, but I would think that the emphasis is on eternal death if there's no way to mitigate sin. Now, there is a path to temptation. And if you will indulge me for a minute, I will tell you a little story that happened some years ago. And I will tell you what happened in an experience that I had. Years ago, not too many years ago, I did a lot of traveling in the state of Pennsylvania. And especially central Pennsylvania is a fairly mountainous region. There are big mountain chains that go through there. And they're in one spot out there in the State College area, maybe, east of State College and so forth, where Penn State University is. In that particular area, there are 9 or 10 big valleys. One of them is called Big Valley, Nipponose Valley, Brush Valley, Sugar Valley, all kinds of different valleys through there. And then in between each one, there are big mountain chains. Well, I traveled that area fairly heavily for quite a while. And most of the time, I knew where I was going, so I just went that way. And one day I was here, and I wanted to be here. And I was in a pretty big hurry that particular day for some reason. Probably was most days because I'm always running behind. But nonetheless, there was a big mountain chain or ridge, or it's really more of a chain because it had valleys and ridges and whatnot. And it was Bald Eagle State Park. So what I always had to do, I'd get on the state highway, I'd travel to the end, wasn't exactly the end, but to a little pass through the mountain there. I'd travel down there, and I would turn, and I'd come back and come back where just over the mountain from where I had been, and it it would take me over an hour to do that. So I decided, well, hey, I have a GPS. Let's use my GPS, and let's find out if there's a quicker way. And lo and behold, there was. So I followed my GPS, and it took me up the mountain. Now, this is in the wintertime, and it's snowy. Took me up the mountain, and it was going to save me a half hour, mind you, so that was pretty good for me and what I was looking for. Took me up the mountain, and it looked pretty good up there. I mean, there was some snow on the road, but it was fine. I could travel. It was not hard to go up the mountainside. And I got to the top of the mountain, and it still looked pretty good. Didn't seem like it was too bad. It was firm. There was snow on the road, but it was solid and firm. And I thought, hey, this is going to save me some time. This is probably what I'll do from now on. Went down over the mountain into the valley, and it was a fairly broad valley, probably a half a mile. Kept on going, and all this time I was thinking, you know, it is sort of strange. There is no traffic. There is no other vehicles on this road, and I'm a little surprised by that. That with a shortcut, you'd think people would have found it, would know about it, and would be traveling that way, but not to be. So I went on over to the next side of the mountain, or the other side of the valley, and started up the mountain, and I got a third of the way up, and all of a sudden my tires, and I had good tires, my tires started spinning. I thought, well, I'll back down, and I'll give it a little more of a run at it, and I'll be able to make this. Did it again, and I got up. I got a little further, but I didn't probably didn't get quite halfway. And it happened again. So I thought, a couple times of this, and I'll be up over the mountain, I'll be fine. And I backed down, and I knew, because when I came down, I was pretty sure I was not going to be able to go back up the way I had come, because there were some hairpin curves on that, and it was pretty slick coming down through those curves, but it was too late to go back the other way at that point, so I knew my exit had to be out the other way. So I got a bigger run at it, and I got probably pretty much halfway up the mountain, and then I couldn't go any further. So I thought, well, I'll give this another go. And I started backing down, and all of a sudden, bam, my wheel, my car, dropped down to the frame, to the chassis. And I thought, what happened here? So I get out. I couldn't go forward. I couldn't go backwards. I get out. And I look and hear what had happened. The center of the road was solid ice for about probably somewhat over a foot. And that's what I was driving on. But the side was loose, just loose snow. And I had inadvertently backed off of that ice, and I'm down on the frame. So now what do I do? Well, I had no shovel, which I've rectified that by now. I carry a shovel with me most of the time, especially if I'm going to be in any hill country, back roads. But I didn't have one, but I had my snow scraper, which is not a very good substitute for a shovel. And I got out, and I started scraping snow away and went into the woods. Still no traffic, by the way. Nothing coming or going. And I got out. This, fortunately, was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I scraped all that away, and I got some logs out of the broken limbs out of the woods, and I started putting them under my wheels, thinking that, well, maybe I can put enough logs under the wheels that will help me to get a start, and I can get back up on the solid ice and keep on going. Not to be. There was no way that was going to happen. And I'm thinking in my mind, well, I better call somebody, so I get my cell phone out, and I... No cell service. I'm down here in the middle of the mountains, and there's nothing, no self-service or anything. But I thought, well, at least I tell people that if I get stranded, I probably have enough crumbs in my car at any given point to last for about a week. And I had actual real food at this point with me. I had some samples and things, and I had a full tank of gas, and I had a 24-pack of water, and I had my Carhartts and my bib overalls and my hat and my boots, so it wasn't like I was going to freeze immediately or anything. And I figured, well, they'll probably find me here in the spring, but spring was a ways off. So no traffic, no anything for probably an hour and a half. Then all of a sudden, up over the top of the mountain, there popped three snowmobiles coming down the road. And I thought, oh, good, they'll help me. They'll get me out. You know what? I had to jump out in front of those snowmobiles for them to even stop. They wouldn't stop. And I did. The last one, I got out in front of him, and I literally physically made him stop because he couldn't get off of that icy spot either. And he stopped, and he said, oh, I said, we can't help you. But he said, sometime the groomer will be by. I'm thinking, what in the world is a groomer? I thought about it for a little bit and went back to see if there's anything else I could do. I sat in my car, warmed it up a little bit, got warm, went back out, kept looking. Nothing. Nobody coming. All of a sudden, about an hour and a half later, it was probably about 1 o'clock by this time in the afternoon, I hear something, and sure enough, up over the top of the mountain, here pops something. I'm not sure what it was at first, but it was something like a bulldozer, had those kind of tracks on it. It was faster than a dozer, and had a big cab up on top. It was a real tall thing, and behind it, it had this big cast iron or steel sled that it was dragging along. What it did, it just scraped the snow off the top of the ice there and kept it so that the snowmobile, the folks on their snowmobiles would be able to travel a little better. But it didn't cut down into anything. It just kept the top clear and smooth. And he came down and he stopped, fortunately. He said, man, he said, this happens occasionally. He said somebody will follow their GPS, and the same thing that happened to me happens to them. But he said not very often, but he said you're fortunate because there are over 200 miles of roads here in this park. And I just came back by here to head down to the office, which was in the valley, for lunch, and I just, by happen chance, was in an area where I ended up taking this road instead of one of the other roads around, or you wouldn't have seen me today. And I paused, and said a little prayer at that point. So he said, let me go down, turn around. He went down, turned around. He came back up, and he had a big chain, and he made me sign this disclaimer form that if any damage was done to my vehicle, that it was my responsibility, I would pay for it, and so forth. Hooked on to my vehicle, and he pulled me about a mile and a half out to the next state road. And the nice thing about it was he was kind enough, he didn't charge me a thing for it, but I felt like that I had dodged a big bullet at that point. Now, why am I telling you this story in terms of temptation? I'll tell you another little quick example. We recently went to Asheville, North Carolina. And on the way back, we had our GPS on, and we were coming up through the mountains of Virginia, just out of North Carolina on I-77. And all of a sudden, beep, alert, alert on the GPS, and it said, accident ahead. We can save you a half hour if you get off the road and go around it. So that's what we did. And we went, actually paralleled I-77, and we could see the traffic stopped on I-77 for a long stretch. It picked up again then. But we did save a half hour by going that way. The reason I'm telling you these stories is this. God knows where those obstacles, those trials, those tests are. We don't. Our GPS, if we program them right, which I didn't, that first one, and I just followed it wherever it wanted to go. They're great. GPS is great. But if you don't use them right, they can get you in trouble, which mine did. But it was basically because I wasn't paying enough attention, because I could have said I only want to go on certain roads, no wintertime, you know, off roads in the winter, not off of state roads, all those kind of things were available for me to put in there. But I hadn't done that, and consequently, I got in trouble. It's the same thing of lead me not into temptation. You can ask God to help you get through those. Now, there is a second thing we'll address in a minute, but God will help you if we obey him and ask him. God will help us. At least if he doesn't help keep us out of there, he promised that he would make a way of escape beyond if there's something beyond what we can bear. And, of course, in my case, I did get rescued, but it did cause me some trauma. And I did end up being more careful. I got a different GPS that I can do more programming on. Consequently, like when I was coming back from Asheville, it did a lot better. It actually rescued me and saved me and told me where the obstacles were to get around there. God will not lead you into temptation, but God can help you avoid areas where testing, trial, and temptations are. He won't stop if we didn't. If we don't ask him, he won't stop us from going in the wrong direction, taking the wrong road, and so forth. You might think, well, what about Job? What did Job do? He didn't go down the wrong road, did he? Well, let's take a look at Job just for a minute. We heard a little bit about Job last week, but we're just going to read a couple verses in the first chapter of Job. Job, the first chapter, and we'll start in verse 6. We probably know most of the story of Job, how God, what a righteous man he was and so forth. Now, Satan, there was a day, in verse 6, it says, when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro here and there about the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and who shuns evil. This is a righteous man, Job is. So Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear you for nothing? Is it all for naught? Absolutely not. Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? I hope he does that for me. I hope, and I ask him to do that, and we all probably do. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But, he said, now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And, of course, we know that later on he let him afflict him with boils and sores and so forth. But it wasn't that God led him into that. God took his hand of protection off of him. I often think, for example, when we hear of school shootings and we hear of things like that, and I think, well, God, we have told God, get out of our life, get out of our schools, get out of our court systems. And should we be surprised that God then, when God leaves, that his protection leaves also? Well, in the church, obviously, we hope that God's protection is upon us. And God allows things to happen to us sometimes to test us and so forth. But look at Job's response in verse 21. And I've always been amazed at this, and I don't know. I know we heard in the sermonette about the response that, and I think the same thing. Would I say this if this happened to me? In 21, he said, naked, I came. He had now lost all his family, all his possessions, and he was covered in, well, he wasn't yet, but he had lost everything basically that he had. But his response was, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That is a very exemplary attitude that we could look to and hope to achieve as well. Avoiding temptations, and this is what we're talking about, the specific purpose statement, so to speak, is avoiding temptations, which is what we're looking at here, and lead us not into temptation. It takes extreme measures to avoid temptations, and we are going to look at a couple of examples of that that we would probably think is very much in the extreme, at least in today's society. In Romans, the 13th chapter, there's an interesting little comment that Paul makes that I've always found to be enlightening and informative. Romans chapter 13. Now we'll start in, let's back up to verse 12. And Paul writes to the Romans, he says, the night is far spent and the day is at hand. And if he says that back in his day, how much further is the night spent now and the day near to being at hand? Therefore, he says, let us cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. Let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly, or as the margin says, let us walk decently, as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. And here's the point that we want to get. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. Make no provisions for the flesh. Make not provision for the flesh is how the right, this is the New King James, but the King James says, make not provision for the flesh. And how often do we do that? I know there are times when I do, when I make provision for the flesh, I either am doing things that lead me that way, or I'm putting things out there that make provision for the flesh. Things that, some of them may not be exactly wrong, but they're sure not enlightening and they're sure not very edifying or educational or helpful for me in my Christian walk. And I'm sure that we all do that. We make at times provisions for the flesh. And that seems hard not to do at times because we get so engaged in this world and with the life of this world and what's going on around. Right now, for example, is a great example of that, because we can either sort of go with the flow a little bit, or we can go against the grain in this season of revelry and, in some cases, debauchery and so forth. We can either sort of make it easy on ourselves and just sort of go along, like I said, and we can make a little bit of provision for the flesh if we're not careful. It's easy to do. Sometimes it takes extreme measures to avoid that. Let's look at a little bit of history. Back in Deuteronomy, we know that Deuteronomy, basically Moses, they were coming to the land of Canaan, to the promised land. Obviously, at this point, it was 40 years into this trek, 40 years and 11 months, it says. coming into this trek that they had started out, that they would have probably, if all things had gone right, and if they had behaved according to the principles that God laid out for them, that it would have been a lot shorter. But because they didn't, they ended up having to spend 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness till all that generation of people who had left Egypt, all the adults, had died. And then the next generation was going to go into the promised land. And we basically know that. But Moses was rehearsing this, the whole experience that they had had, he was rehearsing this to that new generation to make sure that they were up to speed, to make sure that they knew what this wandering was all about, so that they knew what was going to happen. And he gave them directions about what was going to happen, what they're supposed to do, where they came from, where they were, and where they're going. That's what he was basically laying out here in the book of Deuteronomy. But in Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, one of those extreme measures that God asked the Israelites, the children of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, to do to avoid slipping into the trap of temptation. And it is extreme. It is extreme. We'll read from chapter 7 of Deuteronomy from 1 through 6. So when the Lord your God, and again he's talking to this new generation, brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them. And here's the extremity that we would say is extreme. And utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor shall you show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. Now, why was that such a big issue? Why didn't he want them to do that? Verse 4, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars and break down their sacred pillars and cut down their wooden images and burn their carved images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. And God has called us, we are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. We also are a chosen special people to God. Now, we're not in a physical nation like they were here. We're in a spiritual nation. We're a spiritual church. But nonetheless, we still are special and chosen by God. In verse 16, he says, another little bit of extreme measures of avoiding temptation. Also, you shall destroy all the peoples whom the Lord your God delivers over to you. Your eyes shall have no pity on them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. There's a reason why he said this. He wasn't just saying this because he didn't like those people, although he did have reason not to like them. But nonetheless, there was a reason for it that was based in logic and that was based in fact. And if you remember, King Solomon, he had the same issue. He wasn't supposed to marry all these outside women from outside his particular culture, because that's what God said about that. In the latter days, those wives that he has will lead you astray. And they did. And he had a lot of wives to lead him astray. In chapter 13 and verse 5, just another little what we would think or seem to be extreme. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, if there's one among you, shall be put to death. In verse 1 it says, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, he said, that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death. Now, this is not somebody that God has raised up. This is somebody that God has not raised up. Because he has spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage, to entice you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk, so you shall put away the evil from your midst. We, as just mentioned, we are a peculiar and special people to God too, and we have to take extreme measures. We're not a physical nation. We don't have the right to do what's mentioned here. But in spiritual terms, we have to do the same thing. We have to take the extreme measures that it takes to remove those temptations and avoid those temptations from our life so that they don't ensnare us and pull us into the wrong kind of worship or doing those things that we're not supposed to do in a godly life that we are trying to lead. Deuteronomy 20, verse 16 to 18 is another, just a little example of utter destruction that they are to do. Deuteronomy 20, 16 to 18. In verse 16 it says, but of the cities of these peoples which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. You shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, just as the Lord your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations which they have done for their gods, or the abominations they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. Now you might ask, why was God being so adamant that they eliminate all of this? In Deuteronomy 9, it starts to address this. Deuteronomy 9, and we'll read from 1 to 5. Deuteronomy 9, 1 to 5. It says, hear, O Israel, when Moses gave this address to him in Deuteronomy, they were on the verge of crossing over into the promised land, into the land of Canaan. They were on the just north, I believe, of the Dead Sea, ready to cross the Jordan and go over towards Jericho. Hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan today and go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourself, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the descendants of the Anakim. The Anakim were the giants that lived in those days, or had lived. They were descendants of the giants, whom you know and of whom you heard it said, who can stand before the descendants of Anak? Therefore, understand today that the Lord your God is he who goes over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them and bring them down before you. So you shall drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord has said to you. Do not think in your heart after the Lord your God has cast them out before you, saying, it's because I'm of my righteousness. I'm so righteous. That's why the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. But it is here is why he wanted them to destroy these nations. He wasn't just giving them this land because he liked them better than the people who were in the land. It is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God drives them out from before you. that he will fulfill the word which the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God knew what was coming. Now, why is it that a little wickedness would cause God grief? We're not going to turn there, but you may want to jot this down and go back and read it for yourself. Leviticus, the 18th chapter, outlines and details what it was that was so bad about these nations. It was everything from homosexuality, bestiality, incest. It was sexual rituals in their worship. It was burning their own children on altars as sacrifices to their gods and other things. God says, the nation that does this, I'm going to vomit them out of my mouth. I'm going to spit them out of my mouth. And he did not want the nation of Israel to get involved with that. He did not want them to be tempted by that. That's what they came out of from Egypt, and he did not want that going on. He did not want them doing it. And that is why, because of that wickedness, that these people no longer deserve to live in those lands. But today, we're in a different society. We're, as it were, we're just pilgrims and sojourners in a land where we're not in the authority, and we don't have the right to kill and to dispose of and utterly destroy, as you said, these people like that just because they're violating God's laws or they're violating the principles of God. But does that mean that we just go along and let everything happen as it will? Well, Jesus Christ in Matthew, the 5th chapter, talks about other extreme measures that we as Christians, we as followers of Jesus Christ, we as those trying to do our best, do as we heard in the sermonette, to do what is right, to do those things that pleases God. He said, here's what you do. In Matthew 5, and it's in verse 29 and verse 30, he said, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. Now, again, this is not literal. This is figurative. But it's extreme. He says, if there is something that leads you into temptation, if there's something that causes you to err, to sin, entices you to sin, or maybe it's something that's causing you trials, take whatever extreme measures that it takes to get rid of it, to eliminate it from your life, because it's not helpful. It's not going to get you where you want to go. In verse 30, well, let's finish verse 29. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members should perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. Again, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. It's more profitable for us to eliminate something if... And I know people who have done this, and it's not all bad. It's at all, I don't think. If TV causes you to sin, I should probably get rid of my TV, is what it amounts to. I should probably eliminate it. I don't watch a lot of TV, but there's a certain thing that I watch. It's called football. And I could probably do with less watching football in my life. I'll just be candid and let you know that up front. I don't do a lot of other TV watching, but maybe at some point, maybe that's what I'll have to do. Get rid of the TV so I can't watch football. Of course, I'll probably be watching it on my smartphone then, but hey, who's counting, I guess. But if you were in Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, that they have a method that they suggest, and it works. They've done it for years. Avoid those places and those things that cause you to be tempted by the life that you are living or the life that you want to get past. Avoid those places. And that may be avoid those people. Like, for example, the people around you are probably wondering, wow, what's wrong with them that they won't run with us to the same excess of revelry that we do? I think it was Peter who wrote about that. Changing our habits can be or can seem extreme while we're doing it. Just like throwing out my TV, it could seem like extreme. But if that's what it would take, if it's causing sin or if it's causing temptation or if it's causing trials or whatever, and maybe the trials come from my wife because she'd like me to do something besides watch the football game, I think. But at any rate, if that was the case, maybe that's the extreme you'd have to go to, if that's one of your Achilles heels and tendencies. But habits, to change habits, takes extreme measures. To change our habits away from temptation takes extreme measures. We do need to pray and ask God, lead me not into temptations. Just like my GPS led me down the wrong road. It didn't know. It was, you know, it can't think or doesn't know anything, but I didn't program it right or it wouldn't have happened. I would have had a lot easier life just taking that extra half hour and going around the mountain instead of going through the mountain. But I learned a valuable lesson from it. Lead us not into temptation. God, Jesus Christ specifically, told us to ask God for that. And we should do that. In our prayers, we should ask God to don't let me go down that road that will cause me grief. Don't let me go down that road where the stumbling blocks are. We are supposed to learn the lessons from the past. 1 Corinthians 10, 1 to 12 or 13 or something like that. We're not going to turn there. But nonetheless, Paul writes to the Corinthians and he tells them, these things were written, these things happened, and he's talking specifically about the things that we were talking about back in Deuteronomy. These things happened for our examples, and they were written for our admonition, for our instruction, so that we do not have to make the same mistakes that our forefathers made, that others in time past made. We can, hopefully, we can learn from others' mistakes and not repeat those mistakes, because, after all, they lead where we do not want to go, just like my GPS did. There is a way, and this is in Proverbs, the 16th chapter, and this is a very, very familiar scripture. I think I've heard this scripture probably a lot since the first day I came into the Church of God. There is a way, there's a road, a path that we do not want to go down. And here's why. There is a way that seems right to a man. That's Proverbs 16:25. But its end is the way of death. And that's exactly what we do not want. That's what we're trying to avoid. The way that leads to harm and destruction. The way that leads to temptation. The way that leads to testing and trial. Now, we're going to be, just naturally in the course of life, we're going to be tested and tried. And we need to be at times for a number of reasons. One thing says God, a son whom he loves, he chastises. There are times when we need to be, we may need a course correction where we need to be have a little bit of an adjustment. There are times when we need chastisement. There are times when we need some trials and so forth, and we're going to get it. We're going to get them just in the natural course of living our life and leading our life, because we're physical, we're human beings. When we don't get enough to eat, we get hungry. When we hit our head on the ground or on a wall or something, we get a concussion and we don't feel good. when we do violate physical principles, if you jump off of a four-story building, you're not going to start going up. You're going down, and it's going to hurt. If we violate physical principles, we will pay for them. And there are times when we do that. Maybe not on purpose, but we do them anyway. Sometimes through no fault of our own. Sometimes we cause our own issues and problems. But we need to ask God to lead us not into temptation. Lead us away from where those destructive things are. Lead us away from the things that are going to hurt us, that are going to impede our progress, that are going to cause us to stumble physically or spiritually. Lead us in another direction. We can conclude that if we ask God, if we avoid going down the road where those temptations are and not make provision for the flesh, if we do that, if we remove temptation, trials that are in our life by any means necessary, by any means, and it may seem extreme, like what Christ said with the arm or the eye, to remove your eye. And of course, again, he did not mean that in a physical sense, but he meant it in a metaphorical sense, that we remove what is causing us temptation, making us stumble, making us fall. If we do that, and if we are diligent about it, and if we are careful about it, and we watch, we can reroute and avoid the destruction and the disaster that could come into our life.